Hi everyone, welcome to another episode of No Such Thing as a Fish, where we were joined by the absolute legend that is Nina Conti.
That's right, Nina Conti, if you're not aware of her, is one of our great stand-up comedians, but she is also one of the UK's only ventriloquists.
She's absolutely brilliant, she's so smart, she's so funny, she's been on QI back in the day, but now she's come back to join us, and something very special, she has a movie out.
That's right, it's called Sunlight, and it's now out on Prime for free. So if you have a Prime account, you should be watching it straight away.
Absolutely. It's such a good film. I've seen it. It's kind of your classic road trip movie, but with a twist in that one of the characters is like in a giant monkey costume. Sounds weird, but I promise you, I watched it. I absolutely loved it, and I'm sure you will too.
That's right. And if you want more monkeying from Nina, she's even got her own podcast, which she co-hosts with her monkey that she does ventriloquism with. It's called Nina and Monkeys Podcast. It's everywhere where you get your podcasts, so check that out as well. But really, the movie, and I'm going to be watching it tonight. I'm so excited. That's the thing to check out. It's called Sunlight, and it's available now on Prime.
Yes. One more thing to check out, if you so desire, is our Patreon. You can go to patreon.com/clubfish and you will find all sorts of amazing stuff on there. But this week, Dan, there's something very special for everyone, even if you don't pay for it.
That's right. So if you remember, we had Olga Koch on the show a few weeks ago. And as part of it, we were trying to brainstorm the title of a big new movie. So this was about the founder of Grubhub and the fact that he came up with it at school. Olga came up with the name Doughboy. But we asked you, the listeners, to send in what you think the movie should be called, and we made a video going through the process of hearing the pitches from you, the public.
Yes, so if you want to watch that incredibly, well, quite painful 10 minutes that we went through trying to find a good name, it's very funny. I watched it this morning. The Fishbusters have done a brilliant edit on it. You go to patreon.com/clubfish, and when you go there, there is some stuff for everyone. You don't have to sign up for any of the tiers. You will just see it, and this is one of those things.
That's right. So do that now. Check out Nina's movie. But for now, listen to it here on Fish. Here we go. On with the show. Hello and welcome to another episode of No Such Thing as a Fish, a weekly podcast coming to you from the QI offices in Holborn. My name is Dan Schreiber. I am sitting here with James Harkin, Andrew Hunter Murray, and Nina Conti. And once again, we have gathered round the microphones with our four favorite facts from the last 7 days. And in no particular order, here we go. Starting with fact number one, and that is James.
Okay, my fact this week is that one of the most important people in Incan society was the ventriloquist.
Nice. Mm.
That's incredible. I mean, with a puppet, with a not moving their mouth, what
not
kind of ventriloquist?
Not so much a puppet. It was, they were trying to throw their voice. So this is something I read in Encyclopedia Britannica. And it was about the Inca religion where they had a priest called the Yakaka who would tell the future with fire. So they would set a fire, they would blow a pipe and the flames would bounce around. And he would take some coca leaves and then he would supposedly summon the spirits. And when they came in the smoke or whatever, or in the fire, he would start to divine the future, say what's going to happen, say what the leaders should do. And a chronicler called Pedro Chiesa de Leon said that they did it by ventriloquism.
Hmm.
It sounds like a good act.
Yeah.
There was a rumor about the Oracle at Delphi being a ventriloquist thing behind it, but yeah, also that there sometimes a sort of tube or a tunnel leading back from the mouth that somebody is speaking into, like one of those things in the playground where you...
Yeah.
Yeah. I would think Incan society, there are a lot of severed heads going begging, you know, so you could have the puppets if you wanted.
You could, yeah. But that wasn't a thing then, was it? Ventriloquism, when it started, wasn't to do with puppets. It was projecting the voice to make people think it was coming from somewhere else.
So like, this is what this is. It's projecting the voice.
Yeah.
So it's making you think that the voice is coming from somewhere else.
Exactly.
But ventriloquy being the stomach speaking.
Yes. So the Oracle at Delphi, the story was put about that it felt like the voice was coming from either her stomach or sometimes from her genitals.
Mm.
Although those stories might have been written by Christians later who were trying
to... And perverts.
To... Right.
Not always different things.
But gastromancers also is a thing.
Yes.
I don't know whether any of this is true because I learnt ventriloquism from Ken Campbell, who had no respect for the boundary between truth and fiction. But the way he told me was that gastromancers would go into supposedly haunted house and imbibe the spirit up through the genitals and guide into the stomach. And there they would soothe the angry spirit with chat.
Okay.
And then walk away with it.
Oh, what, and expel them outside the house?
Yeah, we would take them up.
Would you fart them out or?
I think so.
Outside. You do that outside.
That's outside.
Well, I mean, who doesn't go outside to fart? Yeah.
Gastromancy was a thing, definitely.
It's all 2,000 years ago. It's all quite hard to tell now. But supposedly, noises made by the stomach were thought to be the voices of the dead. And the other word, I just really like it, because you said venter and loquir is stomach talking, isn't it? Ventriloquism. Mm-hmm. The other word, if you do the Greek, it's engastrimyths.
Very nice.
I do like.
Yeah, that's good.
So
good.
I like that all the original ventriloquists probably were just people with IBS. It was just rumbly-tumbly going on all the time.
Rumbly-tumbly.
Yeah, sorry, I've been watching a lot of Winnie the Pooh.
It's very difficult to imagine it has anything to do with the stomach. I mean, it's definitely my throat where I do my ventriloquism and my mouth, the stomach.
Mm. There are a few different ways. I mean, I'm not a ventriloquist, but I think there's one which is you're making a noise and not letting your mouth move. Mm-hmm. And there's another one which you make the sound much quieter or louder so it sounds like it's coming from somewhere else.
That
yeah,
kind of
like
thing.
The
yeah.
little man in the box kind of
yeah.
thing, right?
Yes.
And I think this is more like that kind of ventriloquism,
okay.
I think.
Nina, did you ever do the I'm talking to someone over there, or the voice is coming from your trouser pocket?
I'm
sir.
Very bad at that, no. I like a nice puppet to distract. no, I've never been. I think people that do that fool me. I went to a ventriloquist convention, and the guy was doing that kind of calling, Nina, Nina, from miles away, and I was looking around, and he looked at me like I was mad. Where do you think you are? You're at a ventriloquist convention.
That's is this me doing. Vent Haven.
Vent Haven,
yes.
Yeah.
I saw your documentary, which is so good if anyone wants to check out about the world of ventriloquism.
If someone's on the stage at Vent Haven and they do a good act, does the applause come from behind them?
This is it, right? This is the amazing thing, right? The reason ventriloquism works so well is because humans are hardwired to, if you see a noise and if you see something moving.
If you see a noise, you're onto something.
If you hear a noise and if you see something moving, then your brain just puts them together.
Right.
And that's because that's useful, right? If you see a rustling in the leaves and you hear the rustling, then there's a tiger there. You need to get out there sharpish. Right.
Yeah.
Right? But the really interesting thing is that that misdirection can persist for about an hour after you've seen a ventriloquist. So if you see a ventriloquist and they've got a puppet to their side, your brain has decided that's where the sound's coming from. And about an hour later, you'll speak to someone and they're speaking to you and you'll get confused about where the sound's coming from because your brain hasn't worked it out yet.
Interesting.
And that's one's really sure why that happens.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it's a bit like if you're on a train for ages and you're moving and you're moving and then you stop moving, then your brain sort of, for a few seconds, kind of can't work out that you're not moving anymore.
Right.
Or if you're, you know, when you walk onto an escalator and it's not moving and you expect it to.
Oh, there's a good
one. It's all this
yeah.
kind of thing that your brain just gets slightly tricked by the difference in movement.
It feels like a good plot point for a movie where you get someone to watch a ventriloquist, but then you deliver some information directly to their face, but it seems as if it's come from the person next to you. So like, oh, then you're a dick. And they're like,
good plot point.
Cassandra!
Good plot point. They're working on Now You See Me 4 at the moment, I believe. So
very exciting.
I'm trying to work out how I can make use of this.
Yeah, exactly. Where can you...
Do people? Do you ever do signings where people get confused and talk to Monkey instead of talking to you?
Well, I can't do signings with Monkey because he's on my right hand. And he can't hold a pen. But... no, it's very... I mean, even I believe the sound comes out of him in some way because I've done it for so many years that if somebody is going to ask what would Monkey say, I feel like, well, let me go and get him and then I'll be able to tell you, which really is weird.
Nina, in 2010, there was a sort of survey done about full-time professional ventriloquists in the UK.
What's
and it
that?
Was shockingly low. 15 full-time professionals.
Yes!
You're one of the 15. And apparently it might not even be as much currently in 2026.
Because Nina's got rid of them all.
Yeah.
They were all attacked by a monkey.
But that's pretty phenomenal. What the sort of the industry is sort of critically endangered, basically. Mm. Like if you decide to quit,
it's never going to die. No. It's been through worse than this.
Right.
I mean, I think it's here for the long run. For me, it was just like picking up the right pen for making thoughts come out of my head. So it's not really, I don't know, the thought of ventriloquism as being some end of the pier thing with a big wooden mannequin, that might be gone.
Mm.
That might be gone, but yeah, I think yeah. it'll keep coming.
Yes.
You guys used to run Incan Society. I'm just saying. They used to be predicting the battles being won or lost.
Through blowing up the lungs of a llama, apparently.
Oh, yeah.
Inflating the lungs of a dead llama and reading the shape of the veins. The llamas had it so rough from what I read in Incan Society.
You think that's why llamas spit at you whenever you see them, because they remember how badly treated they were in Incan Society.
Nina, you mentioent the convention that you went to before, which was the Vent Haven one. And this is probably the most incredible thing about the world of ventriloquism. There is a museum where a lot of the dummies get donated if, say, the person has passed away or left the industry. And so there's a big house, the Vent Haven Museum, where it's just stacked.
That sounds absolutely terrifying.
A lot of the neighbors complain that sometimes they put the dummies looking out the windows down across at them, and they ask for them to be, I'm sorry, that's scary. You've been inside, presumably, because you've been there.
Yeah, and it's a very unique atmosphere because they're very uniquely bereaved and very uniquely quiet because they shouldn't be quiet. They had voices and they're never to talk again. And so they seem really extra still as having been animated. And they've got these little pictures on them, some of them of them on stage mid-flow. Wow. And so it does have a sort of eerie hand in death, all of that. Some survived a shipwreck.
Yes.
But the ventriloquist went down.
Tragically, they were shouting, over here, over here. And they shouted, over there, over there.
Yes.
Yes, there's some good stories.
That was, I think he was called William Wood, the ventriloquist who died in that shipwreck. I think so. I believe so. And four of his dummies washed up to shore much later. And there's a lot of mystery about what happened to him. Were they killed by pirates? All that sort of stuff. And yeah, so his dummies, either all or just a few, are in Vent Haven now.
Did they become really big on radio, I think? I remember that.
Yeah.
When radio started, you got loads of vents on radio.
Yes.
And obviously you can't see, like people who are listening to this at home, they don't know that actually Nina's lips haven't moved this entire episode so far. But like you wouldn't know, but because the acts were so good, it didn't matter really.
Yeah.
It's a character and a stooge. It doesn't matter that you can't see the lips.
They got mad ratings. I read that. So Archie Andrews and Peter Brough in the 1940s, they got on the radio, as you say, James, 12 million people tuning in. I mean, it's crazy.
My podcast doesn't get anywhere near those numbers.
Is that what you would get anyway for a primetime show, or was that a hugely marked...
I think that was big. I mean, there was only two channels, weren't there?
Of the UK must have been, can't have been much more than 30 or 40 million.
You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
I mean, it's crackers. I was reading a London Review of Books piece all about ventriloquism. It was from 2000. All I can find is this line that Peter Brough, the keeper of Archie Andrews, used it to spice up romantic weekends with his wife.
Oh, no.
I can find no further details. Hmm. I don't know what it means.
I think...
Sounds very sexy.
I think we could tell what it means.
I'm not speculating.
Is he the one who, I think he made a transfer to TV and then he got cancelled because people could see his lips moving?
Not cancelled
in the modern sense.
Not the current sense.
Oh, because he'd never learned...
He probably did, but maybe he just wasn't as good as people wanted him to be.
Yes, he'd let it go a bit when he hadn't needed it.
It's true. There are some sounds which are especially hard, right? The beat, anything which is...
Plosive,
right. That is, I presume there are ways of getting around that.
There are ways of getting around it, but it's best not to fixate on them if you're a young budding ventriloquist out there to try and up the numbers. You can't say because your lips have to meet, so you replace that with a g or a d sound.
Yeah.
G or d. And the techniques are that at the back you have your soft palate and you have the back of your tongue. And if you hump your tongue towards the soft palate, you're making substitute lips in the back of your mouth.
Whoa.
And then if you sort of hold the air behind that and then expel it, you'll get the buh sound.
Mm. That's crazy. You're making extra lips at the back of your mouth. That's mad. I'd never heard that that was how it was done.
Well, yeah. But the main thing is not to worry about your B's sounding like G's, because your main focus should be whether your puppet's making people laugh.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. So,
yeah.
All these things, they mean a lot at the beginning, and then you don't. I've never enjoyed a ventriloquist act less because the bees aren't very good.
No. Do you guys come across Thomas Britton in your research?
No.
He was an English charcoal merchant and concert promoter, and he was killed by a ventriloquist.
Okay.
Mm. Great. Mm. So you're throwing someone's voice to kill them. You're throwing your voice.
Shoot me.
Shoot me. Yeah, what Nina said. Shoot me.
That's brilliant.
Oh, did he play on the idea that he was literally the voice in his head?
It wasn't quite that. Basically, there was a magistrate who was called Justice Robe.
Mm.
It's a great name for a magistrate.
Wow.
But he was a bit of a practical joker, and he knew Britain. And he decided to hire a ventriloquist to throw his voice, pretending to be a spirit. Telling him your end is nigh and you're not going to heaven. And he dropped to his knees in horror, thought it was a spirit, and died from shock 2 days later.
It's a hell of a backfire on a prank, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, I have to be very careful with these powers.
Your powers?
No. Stop the podcast!
Stop the podcast!
Hi everyone, we'd like to let you know that this week we're sponsored by Saylee!
Yep, Saylee, the lifesaver, as I call it, the eSIM. It means that when you are overseas, you can save all of the money that would be drained through the internet, through the phone calling, all that stuff, just by getting this wonderful app.
Absolutely. Saylee is absolutely amazing. They can save you money. They can save you time. You don't have to wait in line at the airport to get a SIM card. And you also have 24/7 support. But the most important thing, I think, Dan, is when you get your SIM card, you don't have to find a tiny, thin little thing to stick in your phone to get your old SIM card out. Oh my
God. I know.
The amount of time I've spent.
And it's in 200 destinations. I'm going on a few holidays this year. I'm not going to lie. Half of the excitement is the fact that I'm going to be able to use Saylee while I'm overseas. Just knowing how much I'm saving. Honestly, I've lost so much money to this before in the past. This is a wonderful thing. If you're going overseas this year as well, do get yourself the Saylee eSIM. And if you download the app and use the code FISH at checkout, you're going to get 15% off.
That's right. So download the Saylee app or go to saylee.com. That's saily.com/fish and use the offer code FISH at checkout and you will get an exclusive 15% discount on Saylee data plans.
On with the show.
On with the podcast.
Okay, it's time for fact number two, and that is Nina.
Well, I was reading Craig Brown's Mam Darling about Princess Margaret. And very surprisingly, we have Princess Margaret's birth to thank for horoscopes in newspapers and the modern day sort of horoscope. What happened was, when she was born, John Gordon, who was the editor of the Sunday Express, was looking for an angle on the way he would write an article about her birth. And he tried to get Cairo, who was an astrologer, to write a prediction for her life. He wasn't around. I don't know what happened. Did someone else answer the phone? His name was Naylor. He managed to get the job of doing this, and he did a rather good prediction for her, and the article was a big success. So then the editor of the Daily Express commissioned him to do another one, and he again managed to predict an airplane crashing. It wow. got lots of things wrong. But anyway, these articles went down very, very well.
And then other newspapers looked at that and went, we should do the same. They hired their own astrologers.
Yeah.
And then it just exploded globally.
And so if he hadn't wanted this article to be about Margaret, we wouldn't have this. And people wouldn't be wondering what my week is going to be like and reading this little thing.
That would be awful news for any tall, dark strangers, wouldn't it?
We should say Princess Margaret. For any international listeners or younger ones, maybe, younger sister of the Queen.
The true Queen.
Yeah.
absolutely, the true queen, yeah. The late queen.
You're no longer with us, yeah.
We no longer with us.
For international listeners.
Queen Elizabeth II had a younger sister whose name was Margaret.
Yeah.
Very much the queen's evil twin, I would say.
What? Would you say so?
Come I on. Would, I would.
I don't think she stood a chance at that life.
No. No one in that family has a chance of being normal or in many cases, pleasant. But,
for instance, she was told who she was allowed to marry, wasn't she?
Yeah.
Yes.
So there was the Royal Marriages Act of 1772 said that because she was in line to the throne, the queen had to allow her to marry or not marry. Like she had to say, can I marry this person, please? And the queen had to say yes or no.
Mm.
Up until 25, I think then she was allowed to choose. But still wasn't okay.
She'd fallen in love with a dashing divorcee called Group Captain Peter Townsend.
Stunning.
Yeah, but then he ran off with a 14-year-old after her, so I think she dodged a bullet.
Oh. Nobody's perfect. That is true. That's true.
Is that true?
It is true. They certainly met when she was 14. I don't know if they ran off when she was 14.
Is that actionable is what I mean.
I'm pretty sure GCPT's dead now, isn't he?
Okay.
Yeah. So he was, when they met, she was maybe 16 or 17, Margaret this is, and he was, I think, about 35, 36.
Yeah.
So he was a little bit older. He was divorced, which at the time was, you know, very scandalous. And so she was told, you can either give everything up, you can live as a commoner, you give up this, you know, gilded life in exchange for the true love that you've found, or you can keep it all and not marry him. And she tried, I think I'll do the latter. Yeah. Thank you. But as you say, he was probably a bit of a cad. There is a fantastic theory, and it's for anyone interested in Princess Margaret, this Craig Brown book really is. It's terrific. Like it's so interesting that she had evidence. She kept evidence about her relationship with Peter Townsend, because there's lots of, you know, rumor, myth, legend about it. It was only seen to be a relationship because they were together at something and she picked a bit of fluff off his collar or whatever. And that was, oh my God, they're an item. You know, that was at the time huge PDA.
Yeah.
like 70 years ago, just a different time. Yeah. Anyway. But she has a license plate, or she had a license plate, which she got rid of eventually. And her driver said, do you want to keep the old plates from this car? And she said, no, that's an incident from my past, best forgotten. And it was PM6450, what? Right? Now, her driver, John Larkin, had a theory that 6450 is the 6th of April, 1950, and PM is either Princess Margaret or Peter and Margaret, and is potentially, when she lost her virginity, in license plate form.
Cool.
To Group Captain Peter Townsend.
We've all done that.
We've all got.
Wow.
But that's.
Imagine getting plates made.
Yeah.
If you got them made in advance, you could see to it. If you
were
a virgin.
Oh, yes. That's such a good idea.
That is so random.
The thing about her is probably someone to have met, known, and had to work with. She was probably a nightmare. To read about her, she's almost the perfect caricature of the opposite of Queen Elizabeth, who was very down the line, the rule book. She was more, I guess, like rock and roll. She was hanging out with celebrities of the day. There was all these rumors that she was sleeping with many of them. Pablo Picasso. Picasso was rumored to have an affair, desperately wanted to marry her. Mm. Peter Sellers, when he was at the height of the movie industry in Britain, was supposedly having an affair with her. And these stories came out that she used to have a partner called Colin Tennant. When they were in the bedroom during sort of heavy petting, as it was called, I don't know if it's pre-license plate days, she wouldn't allow him to call her by her name. She would say, you'd have to refer to me by my royal title, your royal highness. You had to refer to me as that. And so she was just a total narcissist as well with her power.
Mm.
You know, to me, I don't like any of these stories of like royal family being assholes. And I don't know.
Yeah, I do because it's interesting reading. As I say, I probably would have hated her if I met her in person. Yeah.
It is fascinating hearing things such as dinner didn't start until she arrived. So you'd just be waiting there maybe for hours because she didn't really keep to other people's timetables. So you might be sitting there while the food's gone cold.
And this is at parties, you mean? Like she'd
exactly,
be, yeah, yeah.
Exactly.
You were 5 minutes late to this recording this morning, Andy.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
We had to wait for you.
Yeah.
We did.
Are you saying I'm the Princess Margaret of this show?
Well, I haven't seen your registration plate of your car. So.
I'm still waiting to get them made. I'm really excited.
But I feel, I did find sympathy for her in that book, because just the amount of comment about her appearance and everything, right, yeah, from the word go, there were such trolls, they were diarists, they were very sort of camp and snippy diarists at the time, but they did not let, and I can't imagine an entire life that sort of, you're not really needed. So it's the life of an understudy, and she never got to go on, and she never got to really do anything, and it was a withering sort of life.
She spent lots of her life living in a flat above or below. She and her mum, the Queen Mum, who, as she became, just lived in flats one floor up and down from each other. They mostly communicated by letter. It's so bizarre.
Amazing, isn't
they
it?
Just would write these rather curt, snippy notes to each other, and then a footman would have to carry them upstairs or downstairs.
Like a text fight.
It was, and it's mostly sort of, oh, I'm sorry I said that earlier, you know.
Did the footman ever come down with like three dots?
Wonderful.
That's amazing. And then she did get married and then divorced, right?
Yes. Right? She married a kind of society photographer, and the marriage didn't work out.
She was like the first person in the royal family to get divorced since Henry VIII or something like that. And then all of the current sort of queen's children who all got divorced, they wouldn't have really been able to do that without her, or at least it would have been a way bigger scandal. But because she'd already done it, it kind of meant that it was a little bit less of a scandal when Prince Charles or King Charles got divorced and all the others.
Interesting. Mm. Yeah, I think you're right.
But she wasn't at all sympathetic to Diana, was she?
Was she not?
No. Oh. No, didn't like it. Didn't like that divorce. Just, it was a real mess.
The book is a story of her being unpleasant to everyone around her forever. Yeah. It's amazing. But the thing about her birth is that I think she was the last royal to go through a particular process. So they were not going to become... her parents were not going to become king and queen at the time.
Yeah.
It was 1930. Right. So George VI was, as he will become, was the younger brother of Edward, who then abdicated. So they were not expected to be really significant royals. But even so, the Home Secretary had to be present.
Was that the one?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
And this is so cool. So her mum was the Duchess of York. And the Home Secretary was a guy called J.R. Clines at the time in 1930. He wanted to go to Brighton on his summer holidays. It was August. And he was told, no, the Duchess of York is heavily pregnant. You've got to stick to her like glue. And
and the idea was that the Home Secretary, is this right? The Home Secretary had to be there so that no one would swap the child
exactly.
out?
It's exactly that.
It's amazing.
And
isn't it?
I know. So he wants to go to Brighton. The Duchess of York says, I think I'm going to go to Glam's Castle in Scotland, like, just the opposite of Brighton. And someone said, well, just pop up on the train when she goes into labour. And he said, no, I can't do that. I can't. So he had to go up. He went up on the 5th of August with his ceremonial secretary, and they had to wait until the 21st of August, 16 days, doing nothing in a nearby castle.
She wasn't in labour for all that time, was she?
No, she was just she was just nearly due.
She was late as usual.
She began her life inconveniencing someone, and she carried on.
Wow. Do they not? They don't do that anymore, do they?
Oh, yeah.
The Home Secretary does.
Shabana Mahmood is on speed dial.
I'm actually really impressed that you could remember the name of the Home Secretary
at time of recording.
The place where she could let her hair down and sort of wear a caftan and everything was Musty. Then you can see that property. You can rent that property for £35,000 a week, dollars a week.
Oh.
And I've looked it up and it's really good. Can we all pitch in?
Sure. What is it? Is it like a Caribbean island, or is that the one up in...
Can I just say that I'm not really up for pitching in for a Caribbean island at the moment because I think they're a little bit tainted.
Yeah. I mean, it's an extremely fancy property.
Is it?
Yeah.
And that was, did she build that up? As in, was that her getaway or did she arrive on something?
The guy you might remember.
Someone else owned it. But when she arrived at the island, someone said, would you like a gift for your wedding or maybe a plot of land? She said, yeah, a plot of land. Thank you. And very swiftly. Then she built a house on that. But this is where she met someone who I think she was involved with, which is a chap called John Bindon.
Mm.
And I only mention him because he was a really dubious figure. He's just a sort of footnote here, but he was a kind of English underworld figure, like very dodgy, knew a lot of gangsters, I think was a gangster in many ways, living in the Caribbean. Anyway, his party trick was that he could hang 5 half-pint beer tankards from his penis. No hands.
No hands.
Wow. He must have been popular at Oktoberfest.
I wonder, yeah.
That's the most 1970s fact I think you could possibly come up with. Yeah.
The ones with handles?
Yeah,
the ones with the handles.
Through the little, handle.
Yeah, half pint. But with the handle. Yeah.
Right. And that was his party trick.
Yeah, it wasn't his day-to-day.
Right, no. But you'd see it coming, wouldn't you? Sort of, he's brought the mugs. He's brought the big cups.
The mugs.
This week on Britain's Got Talent.
Anyway.
Yeah, I don't know what to say about that.
We could do that on, like, because, like, the ventriloquists on the radio, no one could see them. Like, for all the people at home, no, you could be doing that right now.
We're all doing it right now, even me.
Most of my stuff's about astrology.
Let's do it.
Okay.
Have you heard of William Parron?
No.
He was the astrologer to Henry VII and Henry VIII, because it used to be that you would have royal astrologers. He prophesied that Henry VII's wife, Elizabeth of York, would live until she was 80 years old, and she died when she was 37. He forecast that Henry VIII would have a happy marriage and long marriage to Catherine of Aragon, and that he would sire many sons, and that he would become a devoted servant to the Catholic Church.
Right. Oh. It's a tough gig, isn't it, being an astrologer?
Anyone messed can make him, everything yeah. up. Yeah. Like, he got everything wrong. Yeah. But the reason, basically, that he did it is because in those days, as an astrologer to the king, you basically had to say really good stuff.
Yeah,
it's like being an advisor to Donald Trump. You basically had to say your hair's looking great today, Donald, kind of thing.
And will tomorrow.
Because the two astrologers to Henry VI had been executed on grounds of treason when they forecast that he would have a violent death. So you really couldn't forecast bad things, otherwise you get...
Yeah.
There was someone even at Henry VIII's time, Elizabeth Barton, the Holy Maid of Kent.
Oh, yeah.
And she was predicting the king's death. Yeah, she wasn't even...
She wasn't like an official person, was she?
No. She was just sort of wandering mystic. And I think she was executed for it.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a horrible thing to say something's going to happen to anyone with or without the stars. I mean, just too invasive a thought.
It's true. Mm. Mystic Meg, though. Like, she
never said you're gonna die to someone in the audience, though.
Imagine if she came on and was like, I don't know what the lottery numbers are this week, but I got some bad news for Susan in Kent.
Time for fact number three, and that's my fact. My fact this week is that when Caucasian tourists started visiting the mountain gorillas of Congo, local guides went around wearing envelopes as masks so as to help the gorillas get used to the idea of white people. Mm. Yeah, this is all to do with gorilla tourism, which is a huge help to many countries. Mm. It helps the gorillas themselves because it relaxes anyone wanting to poach them because they'll make more money by protecting them. Mm. Not like an egg, Andy. This is the poach word. Is that what you thought I was saying?
No.
Right.
You need a very big pan to poach a gorilla.
Sorry, you gave me a look as I said the word poach, and I thought, hey, he thinks I mean eggs.
No. And he's reading the newspaper going, why are they arresting all these people and just making eggs? I don't understand it.
I gave you a look down because you said it relaxes the people who would otherwise poach the gorillas, and I just thought that was a funny way of putting it. That's right.
I saw a video which had this story in it, and it was at the Kahuzi Biega National Park in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And the gorillas that they have there are the largest gorillas in the world, the Eastern Lowland Gorilla. So when gorilla tourism happens, a lot of white people start arriving from overseas, and largely the gorillas there haven't seen white people before. So there's this one instance where the locals got all these envelopes and they cut holes for eyes, two little nostrils and a mouth, and put a little bit of rope and tied it up. And they spent two or three times going back to meet the gorilla, because every time it kept running away, it was very scared. Mm. And eventually it got used to the look, and they thought, we think we've got this right. So they asked the local authorities to provide a white man to test it out on. And so he came along and it didn't run away. And then they're like, great, the gorilla's ready.
Oh, I thought like he would have run away until he put a little stamp on the top of his head.
Yeah. So it's just a thing that happens because gorilla tourism from Europeans, from people coming over for America and Canada provide huge amounts of money for a lot of different countries and a lot of local areas.
Yeah, it was controversial, wasn't it, at first? Because obviously the dream is for the gorillas to be living without human, without any tourism, really. But it, as you say, it brings in so much money. And that money also gets, they've innovated, so it's definitely put back into the local community. So everyone who lives nearby is also on board, and that's helping with living standards there, and like, just it's helping build up those communities and things.
Well, in
like
places like Rwanda, where you know you had these huge outbreaks of war, gorillas were almost completely made extinct off the back of it, or were certainly heading that way. So anyone who wanted to protect them was risking their life, but they weren't really being paid for it, and that's what this is now providing. And so yeah, it's I've never done it myself. I've never gone, Nina, just purely because of your connection to Monkey. Have you ever thought to do something like that?
Well, I don't think I'd need more than an envelope on my face to relax a gorilla, I think. If I met a gorilla, I'd send out so many signals to it to kill me. I'd just then put myself in that thing. It would all be fear and need, and the air would be electric with this sort of nosedive I'd be doing mentally. I love gorillas. I love orangutans. I love them. I want them to be safe. But I can't even imagine that a gorilla particularly cares about a face or the colour of face. I feel like they would size you up, your weight, your, you know, your edibility.
There's eye contact. And
eye contact,
I think the important thing, if you're near a gorilla, and if you're listening and you're near a gorilla right now, this might save your life, is just go low status. Don't go in, you know, big swinging dicks, thinking you're all that. Just look at the
pint
ground.
Glasses
No pint glasses.
He died showing his party trick.
But is it like, because there's quite a lot of different animals that half of them, it seems, you have to like make yourself big and scary. And the other half, you have to either run away or make yourself very small. And
absolutely. Yes. Don't run away because they can run at 25 miles an hour. Don't make yourself big and scary. Don't make eye contact. And they might sort of passive aggressively brush past you in that way of, you know, they're a commuter who's like
did you spill my pint?
A little bit. And you just sort of say, okay, yeah, fair enough. That's on
everything.
Me. Yeah. And if they're charging at you, don't do anything. Don't run away.
Yeah.
Because most charges are a bluff.
If anything, make yourself a bit smaller, go on the ground slightly so it doesn't look like it's being intimidated by your size either. There's this whole sort of FAQ page on the Virunga National Park, which is in Congo, and it tells you all these details. So if it does get to you and it's angry and you're down on the ground, let it attack you, it says. The attack may include severe biting and pounding or tearing with the gorilla's hands, but it will eventually stop if it sees you as not a threat. It might then just fold you into its arms and just sit with you. Let it do that.
Oh my God.
Don't try and take its arm off because its arm...
Don't try and take its arm off.
How strong do you think I am?
That's very ambitious.
Don't try and lift it.
It's like, you know, if like you're in the cinema and you're on your first date and they put their arm around you and you like take it off them, they say, don't do that. Basically.
Don't do that. Don't with do the that. Gorilla. Remain quiet and passive until it loses interest and goes. It has all of this on its website, and right underneath all of this is a button that says, book online now.
Wow.
Diane Fossey, by the way, who was one of the great primate professionals. I don't know what
like
you
would call it. Like a Jane Goodall?
Yeah, her and Jane Goodall. There was one other as well. The three of them roughly at the same time under the sort of mentorship of a man called Lewis Leakey all went out into different bits of the world and studied primates. And she was not a fan of this gorilla tourism. But I think it was different then. We didn't know quite enough, and we didn't know what good it does for them now.
And the money wasn't going into local areas as well.
Yeah. We didn't even know they existed until like the mid-19th century.
Really?
Yeah.
That's incredible.
In the West, obviously, in Europe. So there was an American missionary called Dr. Thomas Savage, quite a good name for someone who likes to find gorillas, but he went to Congo in 1847. And managed to be told by the locals where to see those gorillas. And he brought back some bones and stuff and then brought them to scientists in Europe. And they then described gorillas for the first time. And then there became like this big sort of thing of everyone loved gorillas. So you had gorilla ballets in London.
Really? And tutus and...
Oh, no, sorry, no. It was people... It wasn't actual gorillas.
Oh, thank
it was
God.
Like...
not like the bear baiting. And
yeah, sure, no, no, no.
Costume for that show is very, very high risk job.
It just became fashionable to do like gorilla themed things.
This is the curtain opens and the costume designer sat there with a gorilla in his arm over him. Help me.
The ballerina who normally gets thrown a couple of feet in the air just goes right through the ceiling. No, there was also a gorilla quadrille for piano that was very popular. The sheet music was very popular. So yeah, it became like a little bit of a meme.
That's great. I love a micromania, which always happens whenever there's anything new. The really impressive people who work in these two national parks where you get mountain gorillas, which is one of the rarest kinds. There are lots of other kinds of gorillas, but the mountain ones are the rarest. The really impressive people are the vets who are patching them up after they've had fights with other gorillas.
Wow.
So they go in to the gorilla's territory every day in small teams. They're checking their health and they're stitching up the gorilla inflicted wounds, and you can't put a plaster cast on them if they've got a fracture.
No.
They do put casts on, sorry, but it's not plaster because they rip it off. So you have to put on a fiberglass one and then paint it to match their fur.
Wow.
They paint the cast back. It's so interesting. This
amazing.
It's really hard work.
Do they fight
obviously.
Each other a lot?
I think a reasonable amount, yeah. Because you get male groups, don't you? You get family groups and then you get all male groups.
Oh, yeah.
And I think there's a sort of lad pad area, and then they'll occasionally leave the lad pad and try and found a family and things like this.
These doctors, by the way, Andy, they're amazing because not only have they been patching them up, and supposedly this has been responsible for the survival rate, they're going much higher, the fact that they've got dedicated doctors now, but also there's been a lot of mysterious gorilla deaths that they don't understand. So if a gorilla dies, it kind of dies on its own, and then by the time anyone finds it, it's half gone, the body's disintegrated somewhat, and they can't really work out what it is. Doctors have managed to get to gorillas that have recently died and worked out that one of the biggest killers is...
Ventriloquists.
No, but it is vent.
That's so sad.
It is ventilation because it's humans passing on the common cold and flu.
Yeah.
And they're really susceptible. Awful. So people, tourists, when they go there and they probably go, God, I'm going to just hide the fact that I'm feeling a bit ill so that I can see the gorillas. They're passing on really dangerous disease.
I think you had to wear face masks, didn't you? Even before COVID, it was one of the places that, you know, you would see people in Asia wearing them and you would see people on safari wearing them.
Yep, exactly. Yeah. They
still I think you have to stay seven or 10 meters away from the gorillas now because just, you know, don't give them a cold.
Mm.
Yeah.
That's the reason.
Yeah.
That I'm not going to stand right next to a gorilla. No, I would. I totally would. I just feel a snivel.
But take their arm off, but make sure then you wash it for 10 seconds while singing happy birthday. I remember there was this thing about they gave you like glasses, which it looked like your eyes were looking in a different direction because of the eye contact thing. Do you remember that?
Oh, cool. Really?
Yeah. You could print them out and there'd be a tiny hole in them so you could see the gorillas, but the gorilla would think you weren't looking directly at them.
Be careful which way you turn your head and accidentally set it off.
Yeah, that's true.
You're staring at a baby gorilla, meanwhile mama's standing there.
Exactly, you're staring right at the one on the left, yeah.
And there was also a thing in Toronto Zoo where they asked visitors to stop showing gorillas videos on their phones. And the people in the zoo just said, we'd rather you didn't do that.
I took Monkey to the zoo once and they really did react. The capuchins or little ones, they were little ones. And they went jumping around, they went crazy. And it was, that was really extreme.
You had your hand up one of their friend's ass. Like, that's not going to...
Are we all going to get this treatment?
Yeah.
They really didn't like my material either.
Okay, it's time for our final fact of the show, and that is Andy.
My fact is, the greatest Shakespeare editor of all time is also the worst Shakespeare editor of all time. This is about a guy called John Payne Collier, who was an academic in the 19th century and a really well-known Shakespeare scholar. And the only thing you need to know for this is that basically there's no original Shakespeare manuscript. So
when they say like first folios, what are they?
So first folio is the first collection of plays. And we have a few that were printed in what's called quarto, which is where you fold the sheet of paper twice. It's sort of a cheap early edition. We have a few first quarters.
But we don't have him actually writing it.
Exactly. Right. We've got no manuscript. And so the search has always been to find the most original possible version of Shakespeare's plays. And most plays that you get these days are a combination of quartos or first or second folios. The folios are the collections where they were first bound up, right?
Right.
So you need to find something as early as possible to get more authentic Shakespeare. That's the thing. And so this scholar, John Payne Collier, 19th century, he found a book in Great Newport Street in London, and it was a copy of the second folio, which was printed less than 20 years after Shakespeare's death, right? So relatively contemporaneous. And he noticed, when he properly looked at it, that there were 20,000 handwritten corrections in the margins of this text. There were extra bits, there were the observations. So this was extraordinary because this would make the book he had found the most authoritative version in existence of Shakespeare's work. This would make it super significant.
Cool.
Yeah, really exciting. People went nuts. Like, he had moved Shakespeare studies forward massively, and he'd faked it all.
Really?
That's the punchline.
Yeah.
That's why he's the worst of all time.
They were his annotations.
Yeah, people noticed, didn't they, that the handwriting looks suspiciously similar to his actual handwriting.
So his own handwriting exists somewhere, does it?
I think we've got his Shakespeare signature.
We have six
signatures, but that's about it.
But he spells the word Shakespeare, the surname Shakespeare, different every single time.
So this John Payne Collier had become the talk of the town. It was a huge deal. This mysterious figure, the old corrector who had made these 20,000 annotations, it was all just complete nonsense.
Why did he do it, Andy?
I don't know. I mean, why does anyone forge things? Like professional glory, glamour? I mean,
he was already at the top of the game.
He was.
He was the guy. So to do that was...
Maybe for the lols?
It was for the lols.
And this book was very successful financially when he printed, you know, here's my version of the volume. So it did make him a lot of money at first.
And I guess he weirdly was collaborating with Shakespeare because he was suggesting edits to certain lines and rewrites, wasn't he? Which would have then been taken up as the new version, possibly.
Yeah.
Or at least certain texts would do that.
True. Yeah.
So
I should say this all came from a fantastic Financial Times article about it. It was really, really good.
What was the period, Andy?
This was the mid-19th century that he was
covering this. Shakespeare at this stage is becoming like...
He's dead,
His plays are becoming a big deal, right?
Yeah, they had a weird
went up and down, didn't they?
Yeah. There's big interest at the time in Shakespeare, for sure. Yeah.
I'm really curious what these notes were that he had 20,000.
Oh, 20,000.
That's a lot of improvements he wanted to make.
Yeah.
And were they alternative line readings or what were they?
I think some of them were, yeah. And others were just skipping or amendments or, I think a bit of everything. It was a lot of changes. Yeah.
But he's putting it on a very old manuscript as well. Like on top of anything else, that's desecrating this. This very important. It was old, presumably. Yeah. Because I think they worked out the ink that he had used clearly was not ink that was from the time.
It was new ink.
Like it went to that kind of forensic level.
He really hadn't thought it through.
No, he probably just sort of get away with this. I mean,
There were quite a lot of people who were making changes around that time and even before that time, weren't they? So Baudelaire is the famous one. Like Baudelaireizing means to sort of change something because you make it less rude, I suppose. But it wasn't just him. Alexander Pope, who's a friend of the podcast, he was changing Shakespeare and rewriting bits that he thought weren't good enough.
Mm.
And he thought I could make it better. Lewis Carroll, he made some version of Shakespeare plays where he cut out all the obscene bits.
Mm, wow. Okay.
So it was like quite a trend of people thinking, oh, this is very lowbrow. We're going to remove that stuff. And some people thought that the reason that Shakespeare put those rude bits in was just because the audience liked it. And really, if Shakespeare had his way, he would have made it all very highbrow.
That's how I feel. But actually, I always think about when it comes to the funny bits in Shakespeare, which aren't always very funny, and the fool is often the real low point. That's what that guy did. The guy who did it first. That's what he did. It was his bit and he knew how to make that funny. And then it's almost like doing somebody else's material. I don't know if that's true, but I mean, that's what it feels like.
I know what you mean, because Shakespeare would have had his favorite.
He would
actors.
Have had a real funny guy who was hilarious with the skull or whatever. But
but in 400 years, a Michael McIntyre routine won't have the same punch that it does today.
Untrue. untrue.
I can imagine Dan getting some old Michael McIntyre scripts and just rewriting them a little bit.
Mandraw.
Yeah. Nahum Tate was another one in the 17th century. This is only about 60 years after Shakespeare died. Rewrote King Lear to make both the king and Cordelia survive, which, spoil it, they don't in the original. For 150 years, the character of the fool, who's a big deal in King Lear, and he's not very funny, but he's very integral to the plot, you know, making King Lear realise he's been mad, you know. The fool didn't exist in the play for 150 years because Nahum Tate wrote him out.
Wow.
And this is why people need original Shakespeare's, is because it's very hard to tell what is in the original text if you're going off even something slightly later.
Yes, yeah. Right. And this, the Royal Shakespeare Company, which you were part of, Nina.
I was there for years.
That's been a hugely important thing in getting Shakespeare back onto the stages in the West End. In Stratford-upon-Avon has become the place that people now go to see. I mean, that's where you were based, weren't you?
That's where I was based.
Yeah, for those years.
Did you start as a spear carrier and then work your way up?
And I never managed to work my way up. I was furniture, really. I was what's called player's cast, which means you just sort of get in, you get the odd bit to do. I did play Audrey in As You Like It, made a lot of it, I think. It's not many lines. And I was the courtesan in Comedy of Errors. And it was really, they worked you very hard. You never had a day off, and you often had to go to a voice coach, or you were just working all the time. But I didn't have very much to do on stage, and that did make me mischievous, and it did make me want to do something more. And that's when I became a ventriloquist, actually.
Oh, wow. Well.
Yeah.
Interestingly, William Shakespeare was an amateur ventriloquist.
Was he?
He could throw his voice behind an arras. That's a specific Hamlet-based joke. James, you can plug a laugh in there, can't you?
I can try. It'll be hard to find a realistic one for that joke.
No, so...
Because Polonius is hiding behind the curtain Hamlet says a rat and stabs him. Well, the way you all reacted, I thought you didn't.
I didn't know Arras.
I didn't know Arras.
It's a curtain.
I also was too hack. I was too obvious. McIntyre wouldn't have done it.
I do that. The Apollo. Yeah.
No,
he was a ventriloquist.
Well, not really. Vent Haven Museum, the one that houses all of the dummies, was founded by William Shakespeare Burger.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's also something you can buy in Stratford-upon-Avon.
Yeah.
How would you like your burger? I'll have it as you like it.
Superb.
Very nice.
And also the list of the RSC, the Royal Shakespeare Company. It's pretty amazing, the alumni that you're part of, Nina. I don't know who was in your year, but, you know, obviously people like Ian McKellen and Judy Dench and Brian Blessed, you know, all these people were part of it.
David Tennant.
You had Tennant?
In your year?
Tennant was, yes, he was in Comedy of Errors with me. It was his courtesan.
Because it's very serious.
Yeah.
They take it very seriously. Did you ever get to do any more fun productions? Did you ever get to do something like Bouncy Castle Hamlet or whatever it might be?
As fun as it got was a 5-hour play called Back to Methuselah by George Bernard Shaw. That was light entertainment.
Yeah?
I was nude in that and I got birthed from an egg.
Oh, poached? Or...
Very coached. Yeah.
You will, I think, Nina, know about this story. There was a very big hoax that was pulled off for the RSC.
That's a good one.
Yeah, whereby it became, for a moment, the Royal Dickens Company as opposed to Shakespeare. Do you want to tell this story? If you know it, you might know it.
The best I can remember, it's Ken Campbell, who was the guy who sent me on the ventriloquist path. He wrote letters with a fake headed notepaper from the Royal Shakespeare Company saying that we are now moving on to Dickens.
Very good.
We're moving on from the Bard. And he wrote to all the members of the Royal Shakespeare Company and actors offering them roles in Dickens plays.
Great.
And every single letter he signed, Love Trev, as Trevor Nunn.
Trevor Nunn was the artistic director at the time, and I think I'm right in saying that he was away overseas on holiday at the time, so he had no idea. I think I'm right in saying that.
And he wouldn't
have
been in contact, because it's not like you're on your emails, because this must have been a while ago.
Yeah.
That's so good. So
he came back to all this chaos, and no one knew who did it, and finally Ken revealed that he'd done it to Newsnight, I think it was, who finally tracked down that it was him, but yeah,
and they gave him criminal lighting, he said, as he was interviewed. But he got hoaxes blues after he posted all these letters, because nobody answered for a very long time,
and really
it seemed like anything was going
to
happen.
Normally if you write to an actor saying I'm offering you work, you'll get a reply by return of post.
I would like to have seen this.
That's
more
so
Dickens
funny.
Society.
Yeah,
I think the weirdest production I've ever seen was in Königsberg Castle in Denmark, when we were on tour in Denmark, and the castle is the original Elsinore, or it's the one that inspired Elsinore.
Yeah,
wow.
I think it's the one, and they were doing kind of walking Hamlet around the place. So you know, you'd see one scene in this room, and then you'd wander off, and you'd see another scene happening in this room, and these actors are kind of running between each bit. But there were some tourists who did not really respect the boundary between art and audience. And there were some who were just wandering up to Hamlet in the middle of quite an emotional scene, just to have their picture taken next to him.
And he's trying
to have his epic final sword fight with Laertes, and there's just an elderly Chinese lady standing literally next to him, touching him, just grinning for the camera.
Fantastic. I did a Macbeth one which was similar to that, but during the scene in Glam's castle, Princess Margaret was born.
Beautiful.
We mentioned earlier about Shakespeare's name, and we have a few versions of his signature. Two of those signatures are on his marriage license and his marriage bond. But on those two documents, the name of the woman is different. So on his marriage license, it says that he was married to Anne Whateley, Whateley. And then his marriage bond says he was married to Anne Hathaway. And we don't know why. It could be. What most people think is probably it was just a mistake and they just misheard it, or in those days spelling was different, and so maybe she was called something in between those two.
Wow.
But there's another version, which is basically he was going to marry this person called Anne Whateley, and then he changed his mind and married Anne Hathaway instead. Isn't that amazing?
That's
though?
Incredible. Like,
yeah.
So bizarre.
It's amazing how little we know about him. I know it's not when you really dig into how much we knew about people, and it's often said we know way more about him than, but we don't know enough to know that he definitely wrote the plays according to a lot of debate.
Like, that sentence? We don't know enough to know that he wrote the plays.
Well,
we don't have
we can't conclusively. It's a big debate, isn't it? Like, you would think for someone we knew
it's
so much
not
about.
A serious debate, though.
Well, Oxford University Press recently gave a co-credit to who was it? One of the major other playwrights.
MacIntyre. There's a brilliant bit where Macbeth. It's weird that it's in Macbeth, but Macbeth is going on and on about, you know, getting onto a plane. And the awkward etiquette. Yeah, it's really funny.
Well, also, a lot of his stories are basically ripped off from other stories.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
So, like, Romeo and Juliet is based on a story by William Painter. We're pretty sure because it's pretty much the same story. Mm. That was based on a poem by Arthur Brooke, which was inspired by a collection of stories by Pierre Boisdau, which was in turn inspired by a novella by Matteo Bandello, who was inspired by a story by Luigi da Porto. So it's like a story as old of time of two star-crossed lovers both carking it at the end.
That's spoiler alert again. Spoiler alert. Sorry.
You're wasted as a blurb writer for the back of books. Okay, that's it. That is all of our facts. Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to get in contact with any of us about the things that we have said over the course of this podcast, we can all be found online. I'm on at Schreiberland on Instagram. James?
My Instagram is no such thing as James Harkin.
Andy?
At Andrew Hunter M.
And Nina?
The Nina Conti.
The Nina Conti, yeah. So follow that because you post up a lot of information about things that are upcoming, including the fact that now available on Prime is your feature-length movie that you co-wrote, you star in, that you directed.
Yes, called Sunlight. Very excited that that's getting out in the world. It's been 7 years in the making and it's my proudest thing to date. So
yeah. James has watched it and says he liked it. James has never said he liked anything to anyone in this room outside of that situation.
Genuinely, if I didn't like it, I would have pretended that I never saw it. But I did. I loved it. I thought it was brilliant.
So good. Well, that's available now if you have Amazon Prime. And
Primate, more like.
Yes, it is more like.
And I have no comments about that joke.
Hey, listen, if you want to get to us as a group, though, podcast@qi.com, send all of your emails there because Andy goes through them all and he cherry picks the best ones for two separate places. We have Little Fish, which is our Monday show where he takes all the best facts that you guys have sent in and we spend a whole episode going through all of those. You can listen to those apps every Monday. And then the other half are the correspondence that we take to drop us a line, which is our audience feedback show. And if you want to get access to that, you just need to go and join Club Fish, which is part of Patreon. So patreon.com/clubfish. You'll find lots of different tiers there. There's lots of extra bonuses. It's a really fun place. So do check it out. Otherwise, come back here next week because we got another episode. Just a quick thank you, as ever, to Ling Lee and Ethan Ruparelia, as well as the Bigger Fish Buster team here at the QI offices. And we'll see you again next week. Goodbye.